Our reading for today is from the writings of Bernard Loomer. He was a process theologian who became a Unitarian Universalist later in his life. And in adult classes that he facilitated at the UU congregation he attended, he would often ask participants, "What is the size of your soul?" For Loomer, size was a defining concept in spirituality. And for emphasis, he usually wrote the word in large capital letters with dashes in between. This passage describes what he meant. By size, I mean the capacity of a person's soul, the range and depth of your love, your capacity for relationships. I mean the volume of life you can take into your being and still maintain your integrity and individuality, the intensity and variety of outlook you can entertain in the unity of your being without feeling defensive or insecure. I mean the strength of your spirit to encourage others to become freer in the development of their diversity and uniqueness. I mean the power to sustain more complex and enriching tensions. I mean the magnanimity of concern to provide conditions that enable others to increase in stature.
Sometimes sermons are kind of selfish. More often than you may think. The sermons you hear from me are really meant for me. Sometimes I preach consolation when that's what I need. Sometimes I preach challenge when that's what I need. So I'll admit it today, I'm preaching what I need to hear today. This has felt like a season of loss for me. Many of you noted that Dottie announced her resignation just about a week before my mom died. This felt like kind of an apples and oranges thing at the time. Don't get me wrong, I love working with Dottie, and I count her as a very close friend and colleague. But she's not dying. And she's not my mom. But a loss is a loss, and I'm feeling more of a sense of loss as her departure gets nearer. And now the proximity of those two losses feels a little more pertinent. And another loss looms larger than I expected right now. Later this week, my youngest kid will graduate from high school. Yeah, and a few months from now, he'll be going to college 1,000 miles away. 994, actually, I looked it up. And at the same time, our daughter, who's been going to college in Chicago, is going to be studying in Hungary. I have to say, I've always kind of looked forward to the empty nest, and I still am in many ways. But it is an end of an era, that's for sure. And although we don't see our son all that much these days, he's quite busy, when we do, he's actually pretty fun to hang around with. So his imminent flight from the nest feels like a loss. Now, of course, sitting for days and months on the pity pot is not always a very good idea. My mom was old. She lived a good long life. And with full faculties, decided that it was time to quit struggling to stay alive another day. And then she went quite painlessly and quickly. Dottie is going on to a really cool opportunity. And this change is good for her family. And this congregation is strong and healthy, and we will get through this just fine. My son is ready for college, and he's picked a college that's a good match for him. So woven into the loss, there is a lot of blessing. But still, I need a particular message today, and the message I need to hear is to acknowledge the loss and live large anyway. So I love the passage from Bernie Loomer that Dottie read. And it suggests that there are two poles in the way we live our lives. On one end, we can live our lives in ways which are tight, constricted, closed. We can allow ourselves to be dominated by anxiety and fear. Our gaze becomes internally focused, or maybe focused just outward enough to take in the little tiny box that is our work and family. Our hands are clenched shut. On the other end of the spectrum, we live large. We live spaciously. Mary Oliver, in her poem, When Death Comes, writes that she wants to be able to say at the moment of death, as she looks back on her life, that she lived all of her life spaciously, large. When it's over, she writes, I want to say all my life I was married to amazement. I was a bridegroom carrying the whole world in my arms. When we live spaciously, we live wide-eyed. We see the world as chock full of opportunity. We live with open hands and hearts and minds. Our soul is large, it is deep, and it is wide. I think of my daughter's boyfriend during Packer games. Okay, this play is huge, he'll say before a key play, just so we notice, especially our daughter who's kind of new to the Packer thing. This is huge. He says it pretty frequently during the game, and in fact, in any football game, there are a lot of big plays. But it's pretty much how he lives his life, too. There seems to be lots of significant moments in his life. He lives like a bride married to amazement, like a bridegroom taking the whole world into his arms. He lives spaciously. And, of course, he doesn't always live like this. None of us always live on one end of the spectrum or the other. The spectrum between living large and living small is fluid, and we move between it as we go through our lives. A great symbol for me of the fluidity of the spectrum comes from literature. The Grinch, Dr. Seuss, who I just love. Now, here's a creature who seems like he's completely at one end of the spectrum. Perhaps his heart literally is too small, but for whatever reason, he lives the small, constricted life where he's not connected to anything or anybody, even his dog. When he hears the sounds of joy emanating from Whoville, in spite of the fact that he's stolen everything Christmassy, his heart grows three times in size. We all have the Grinch in us. Both the Grinch with the too small heart and the Grinch with the heart expanding. Dr. Seuss himself recognized this truth. A few days ago, Marie Merton told me about a self-portrait that Seuss did, so I looked it up. And it's a self-portrait of him brushing his teeth, looking in the medicine chest mirror. And he doesn't see Dr. Seuss in the mirror. He sees the Grinch, a really nasty-looking Grinch. Now, if even Dr. Seuss has a nasty Grinch in him, you better believe you and I do too. We operate on both ends of the spectrum. Here's the thing, though. I have no doubt that life on the end that's big, not small, is much more joyous and fulfilling. Certainly this was true with the Grinch. So how is it that we can live consistently on that end of the spectrum and not this? I'll share a few ways that work for me. A very significant way for me, and I suspect a lot of you, is being in nature. When you're looking out over the Grand Canyon, or looking out from the Grand Canyon, how can you not feel the beautiful enormity and awesomeness of the world? Or when you're lying on your back, clear summer night, on a field, it's dark, and you're looking up at the vast array of stars, how can you not feel the enormity? And for me, it's not just experiences of the vastness of life like that, looking up at all the stars or in the Grand Canyon. There's also smaller experiences that lead to the same feeling. For me, sitting by a Northwoods small lake as a loon goes in and out of the water, listening to the birds and the gentle breeze going through the trees, the frogs croaking every now and then. That's a smaller experience that leads me to the same feeling. From bee song, running through the grass, or standing by a lake, frozen over, middle of winter with a full moon. Those are experiences that can lead us to that. For many scientists, looking into a microscope can give the same experience. Isn't that amazing? That the microscopic can lead to this feeling of enormity, the enormity of life. It's no surprise to me that the call to gather quote that Dottie found today comes from Thoreau. Here was a guy who mostly lived large, and the way he fed that was by connecting with nature, both the immensity of nature and the intricacy of nature. Another important avenue to me to living a large life is connecting with the arts. I don't know how many of you were able to go to the Compassion Project event a few weeks ago, but what a magnificent event. Integrating together music and poetry and art and video and the Dalai Lama speaking and saying the word Appleton. That was amazing. It was a compelling message to try to go out and live more compassionately. I don't know how anybody could have gone to that and not left feeling their heart had expanded by three at least. Listening to the music today, B and J, Eric, same thing. It expands us. It expands us. Speaking of the Compassion Project, simply practicing love and compassion in our lives toward our family and friends and even toward strangers, working for justice, all of these things too can help connect us with the enormity of the world, can help us feel like we have spacious souls. Doing a spiritual practice helps as well. For me especially, one grounded in gratitude. It's so easy when I don't do the practice to start feeling entitled, petty. That practice of gratitude keeps me in touch with enormity. And one final way I want to lift up is to recognize the spaciousness of time. And this one's tricky. When we're rushing through life, it's really hard to do. It's really hard to do when we really understand the shortness of our lives. Even if we live to life expectancy or beyond, our lives are still a blink. And yet, in every moment, eternity is present. Every moment is connected to that eternity of time, connected to everything that went before, all the way back to the Big Bang, connected with everything that will happen after. Sure, we're just a dot on the timeline of the universe, but it's connected to everything. When I am conscious of this, it helps me to stop and to breathe mindfully. And breathing reminds me of the brevity of life. Someday I will not be breathing. But it also reminds me of the continuity and the enormity of life. That same breath I take in will have atoms that maybe the Buddha breathed out. It'll have atoms that come from the Big Bang. I am a small part of something impossibly large. Thinking about this sermon brought to mind a passage from one of my favorite books, Saving Paradise, by Rebecca Parker and Rita Nakashima Brock. Parker is a UU minister. Brock is a minister in the Disciples Church. And they make a brilliant case in this book that the early Christian church focused a lot on paradise. They concluded this by encountering countless depictions of paradise in churches that go back to the first 800-900 years of Christianity, before the bloody crucifixes started to come into being, before the Crusades. And they were surprised, especially, to note that these visions of paradise were not some otherworldly kind of heavenly sort of vision. but they were visions of earth, of paradises that you can see here on earth. So these two authors spent many months searching for glimpses of paradise in these ancient churches, especially in Italy and Turkey. And the passage that comes to mind for me is one that has stayed with me. And it describes one such quest. They're riding up into the mountains of Turkey with their cab driver, Ersin, in search of an ancient monastery. Ersin stops to ask directions from an older woman, and she gets in the cab, and they continue driving up into the mountains. Nakashima Brock and Parker write, "As we climbed, the sunny sky turned gray and began to roil with black clouds. Fat raindrops plopped onto the windshield. The higher we ascended, the more fiercely it rained. Soon the windshield wipers hardly marked the sheets of water pouring over the cab. After a long climb, we emerged into what looked like a big meadow, barely visible through the torrent. 10 bumpy minutes later, we stopped under a cluster of tall trees, and the old woman shook Ersin's hand. They said goodbye in Turkish, and she turned to smile at us and stepped out of the cab. Ersin pointed into the opaque downpour. 'Church,' he said. The hazy silhouette of stone ruins stood just beyond the trees. It had been hot and sunny when we left, so we brought no gear for rain. We covered ourselves as best we could and conducted a quick and cursory look at the ruins, which held little art beyond a few relief carvings on the crumbling walls and capitals. Disappointed and nearly soaked, we returned quickly to the cab. The deluge ceased abruptly, and golden light leaked through the churning clouds. In the crystalline air, a rainbow straddled a vast rolling meadow below a ring of gray-blue peaks. Spread before us were acres of lush, emerald pastures and orchards dotted by swaying flowers and flocks of snowy sheep. The three of us sat in stunned silence in the cab for some time, simply gazing at what we had crossed unseen as it now lay before us, vivid in the golden light. Ersin retraced our route across the breathtaking valley. We rolled down our windows and passed small, carefully tended fields of cucumbers, tomatoes, grapes, peppers, beans, and onions. We smelled the wet grass and earth. Fruit trees sagged with ripe plums, peaches, and early apples. As we approached the turn that would take us down the mountain, we asked Ersin to stop. He pulled the cab next to some sheep and turned off the motor. In the moist stillness, we could hear the ticks of the cooling engine and the rip-click sound of the grazing sheep. On the opposite side of the valley, where we found the ruins, we saw a village nestled in the trees. An orange searchlight of sun streamed through a gap in the mountains, and clouds illuminated the ancient monastery stones. We paused a few moments to breathe in the fragrances brought by the breezes ruffling the grasses and drank deeply of the valley. Then we turned down the mountain. As we headed west, we could see crimson, gold, and mauve-streaked clouds billowing into deepening indigo sky, our last glimpse of paradise as we rounded a switchback and the valley disappeared from sight. Searching for images of paradise, they conclude, we found the real thing. From ancient peoples and lands such as Turkey, Iran, Iraq, Egypt, and Israel, Christians inherited the idea that paradise is in this world. Our arduous journey told us that paradise is neither easy to find nor a guaranteed destination. But with a wise guide and an intrepid driver, we found it is possible to arrive there. Living small, we can miss the reality that paradise is right here on earth, in our backyard, in the nearby park, as well as in the mountains and the Grand Canyon. We overlook that we can find paradise just by looking at each other's faces. For too much of our lives, this reality is veiled, like the lush, gorgeous valley was veiled by that torrential rain in that passage. And so, we need to find ways to pierce this veil so that we can see and drink in the beauty and the enormity of life. It's always there. We just don't always see it. And so I hope for each of you that you will have some magical moments this summer when you see how large life is. Slow down. Smell the roses. Sit and watch a sunset. Hug a loved one. This is my message for you today. Oh, yeah, it's for me too.